Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of H2O Talk. This is the podcast that's all about water and environment. And I'm Tom Bellinger, and I'm here with our co-host, Greg Dewey. How are you doing, Greg?
I'm doing great, Tom. Thanks for being here. It's really good to be here. Thank you.
It's early in the morning. So what we're going to do today is talk about avalanches, avalanche safety. And today we have the director of the Colorado Avalanche Information Center, Dr. Ethan Green, with us. So we'll come to him in a moment. But let's talk a little bit about some water news. And I just have one thing here. This is out of Karlsruhe Institute of Technology. This is in Germany. And this has to do with artificial intelligence. And maybe our guest can talk to that a little bit too. But basically what this article is saying that, there's much stronger precipitation now. Our weather is changing. Strong precipitation may cause natural disasters, such as flooding and landslides. Global climate models are required to forecast the frequency of these extreme events. And modeling, of course, is very important to this type of science. Researchers have now developed a first method based on artificial intelligence by means of which the precision of coarse precipitation fields generated by global climate models can be increased. So we're looking at resolution increases. The research has succeeded in improving spatial resolution of precipitation fields from 32 to 2 kilometers and temporal resolution from 1 hour to 10 minutes. And the higher resolution is required to better forecast the more frequent occurrence of heavy local precipitation in certain areas. So for guys that are in the water and meteorological fields, there's a lot of modeling that goes on. And this is something that we're talking more about, is using artificial intelligence to maybe improve some of this forecasting methods. And AI has its good side and bad side, but I would think that this is a direction we're going to be moving in. So that's my little piece of water news for today.
Yes, that's an interesting concept. I'm curious what our guest, if he has some insights on that as well, because I believe that what you're talking about, the forecasting, is probably an important part of what the Avalanche Center does.
Okay. Well, we'll bring that up. All right, so let's go to our guest today, Dr. Ethan Green. And Ethan, I've met a few times in the past. I have brought some classes to the Colorado Avalanche Information Center, which he is the director of here in Colorado. And Ethan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Greg. Thanks for the invitation. I'm glad to be here with you.
Well, I'd like to know, you have a meteorological background, Earth and Atmospheric Sciences, essentially, background also. How did your life's path bring you to the CAIC here in Colorado?
Well, it's a little bit of a tangled web, but I grew up in Boulder, Colorado, in a family that really enjoyed winter sports, skiing, both in the backcountry and ski areas and mountaineering. And so that was just sort of part of my life. And as I got out of high school, I moved to Telluride to just kind of take a couple years off and ski, and started just being in steeper terrain, and realized that I didn't know that much about avalanches, and that it was something that I really did need to know about. And so I started getting some training, got some good mentors, and kind of got interested in the science of avalanches. And so that's what actually encouraged me to go back to school and start studying this in a more formal way. And then over the course of many years, I sort of bounced back and forth between professional avalanche work at ski areas and for the Forest Service doing public safety and academia. So I kind of, bounced back and forth between undergrad and working in the field and graduate school and working in the field, and had some people that steered me down the wrong path. So I ended up in a PhD program. And at the end of that, the former director, or the director at that time, Knox Williams, of the CAIC, was retiring, and he reached out to me because he was trying to get a good applicant pool for his replacement. And I was sort of on the fence between whether I should stay in academia at that point or go back into kind of more practical work. But, you know, Knox had had that job for 25 years, and I figured if someone had stayed in the job for 25 years, it's got to be a pretty good job. And that if I wanted that job, this was probably my only opportunity to try to get it. So so I applied and got it, and been here ever since.
So when did you start at the CAIC?
In 2005.
2005, so, okay.
Yeah, I'm not quite at the 20-year mark, but getting close.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, in addition to the education you have, which you're more than well qualified, it sounds like you have a passion for the backcountry.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, mountain recreation has always been part of my life. And winter recreation has been a big part of it. It's a little bit of a blessing and a curse. The winter recreation part has really turned into work for many, many years now, decades. And as I'm sure a lot of people out there and you guys as well can relate, like, there's good and bad to that. Like, you know, I think we're all really lucky to be able to work and make a living doing something that we're really passionate about. But sometimes work and recreation get a little mixed up, and you know, it's you got to be careful about making things that you love completely your job. I think I've been fortunate enough to, you know, keep that passion, but certainly it's been complicated. Like, I work at ski areas for a long time, and there was a period where I actually didn't really like to go to ski areas anymore. I recovered eventually. But, you know, backcountry recreation is so varied. It's been easy to keep, to stay passionate about it. One of the things, I live in Leadville now, and, you know, I grew up skiing in the backcountry, you know, doing Nordic skiing. But at that point it was, you know, wood skis and no edges. And we didn't really call it Nordic skiing. It was, you know, sort of like hiking in Rocky Mountain National Park and Indian Peaks on skis. But living up here in Leadville, my kids have gotten into more modern Nordic skiing and racing, and so I sort of followed them into that. And you know, so in my 40s, I guess, I discovered a kind of a new aspect of skiing that I had been familiar with, but not really at the same. It was a different approach. So that was a pleasant surprise.
Well, I'm wondering, the Colorado Avalanche Information Center, what exactly, how is the agency set up? Is it a state kind of agency? I think you can get funding from donations, that type of thing, too?
Yeah. So we're a program in the Department of Natural Resources. So we are a state government agency. And we get funding from kind of three big pots and one little pot. We get funding from the Department of Natural Resources, and that's actually severance tax. We have a contract with the Department of Transportation to provide support for the state transportation system. So we do all the mapping and hazard analysis forecasting for CDOT for all the highways. And so we have a large contract with them on that. And then we have a nonprofit partner, the Friends of the CAIC, and they raise money to support avalanche safety in Colorado. And some of that money they give directly to us for forecasting operations. And some of it they use in kind of partnerships for with us and other groups for outreach and education. So, like, they have a trailhead program right now where they're sending people out to popular trailheads just to talk to people about avalanche safety. And that's funded partly through donations and partly through some grant funding. And then we do get some funding from the National Forest Service directly through Region 2. So those are the main ways that we're funded. That's changing a little bit this next year because a couple years ago, the state created this Keep Colorado Wild Pass program, which is a way for people to get a discounted state parks pass when they register a vehicle. And most of that money goes to public lands in the state of Colorado. Some of it goes to support search and rescue operations around the state, and then some of it goes to support us.
Okay. That's something I've always been curious about.
Yeah, it really stems with Knox Williams, who we were talking about just a minute ago. So the program started in the Forest Service in the Rocky Mountain Research Station in Fort Collins in the 70s, in 1973. And so actually this is our 50th year of producing daily avalanche forecasts. Wow. In Colorado. So we're celebrating our anniversary. But yeah, the program started in the Forest Service in the Rocky Mountain Research Station and was part of a research program called the Avalanche Project that the Forest Service had embarked on kind of in the late 60s, early 70s. And then after a while, the program in the late 70s, the program moved into the Arapaho-Roosevelt National Forest, more of the administrative side of the forest rather than the research side because it was an operational program. And then in the early 80s, the Forest Service cut the funding for the program, and Knox moved it to the Department of Natural Resources that agreed to give the program a home, but no money. And so Knox had to raise all of the money. And so that whole funding structure that we have is really about 20 years of his work, keeping the program going and building a solid funding stream. And then, and then I took over and have hopefully continued in the same vein.
Okay.
It sounds like for this program, it's a very important program, or the state wouldn't be helping to fund it as it is. How prevalent are avalanches, and how important is it for people who recreate to get information about avalanches?
Well, it's extremely important for people that recreate in the mountains in Colorado to get good current information on the avalanche conditions, because as both of you, I'm sure, know, a little bit of knowledge can give you a lot of power. And if you don't know what you're going to be facing going into the backcountry, you're at a really big disadvantage because you have to kind of start from scratch and figure out not only like where you're going and what your motivation for the day is, which is, usually climbing a peak or skiing some area or snowmobiling through some area. Having that knowledge ahead of time so you know what the conditions are like, so you can make a plan that is going to steer you out of dangerous areas, is extremely important. Because then you've got kind of a path for the day, and you can make observations, see whether the conditions are really what you thought they were going to be, and change from kind of a place of knowledge to more sort of boots on the ground informed perspective. If you're going out without that knowledge, you're really just starting from scratch. So just like people should be checking the weather forecast if they're climbing a 14er or, going on a backpacking trip, so what time thunderstorms are going to start in the summertime. Checking the avalanche forecast in the wintertime is really the most important thing you can do to stay out of avalanches. And avalanches in Colorado are a really important natural hazard. It's one of the things that we've been trying to do is to get more education just into the school system. Some of the work that Tom does educating college kids is extremely important. But we've been trying to get kids in Colorado to learn about avalanches at a fairly young age because it is such an important natural hazard for our communities. A big part of Colorado is the mountainous area, and we have, people that are, living, working, traveling, and playing in these mountainous areas, and avalanches kill more people on average and in totality than any other weather-related natural hazard in the state. So we have 6 people a year that die in avalanches, and that has a big impact on our mountain communities. Where we have typically young people that are killed and kind of pulled out of these communities and and leave voids that really impact a lot of folks. So in the environments that we all enjoy, it's a pretty important issue.
I know of some statistics I've looked at. Colorado was probably number one as far as fatalities in avalanches. Is that still true?
Yeah, that is still true. Historically, that is true. We tend to break up kind of the periods that humans are involved in avalanches right around World War II. Because if you look like at the history in Colorado, the most dangerous, and really the whole Western United States, the most deadly accidents all happened kind of in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And these are the times where, you know, people were moving into the mountains to start mining operations or timber operations, building communities. And oftentimes those operations, those work sites and those communities got built in harm's way. Obviously, you don't see avalanches every day or sometimes every year. And so sometimes, these sites got built up until there was, over many years, and then there was a big avalanche and a big accident. So those larger, more deadly accidents are all sort of around the turn of the last century. The natural hazard sort of moved people out of the way. A lot of towns, either relocated or, part of the town just didn't get rebuilt. And so most of our occupied structures ended up in good places. And so then when you move into the early 1900s, we still have some pretty good accidents into like 1920s or something like that. But then things sort of start to die off and we don't see nearly as many deadly interactions with avalanches until around 1950. And that's when recreation really started to blossom, post-World War II with the 10th Mountain Division folks coming back and kind of building the recreation industry. And so then from 1950 on, most of the accidents that we see are recreational in nature and not people living in buildings or at work nearly as much. And so we tend to look at now the statistics from that 1950 period on. We still kind of go back and look at the older stuff, but it's a really different dynamic. Like the reason that people were involved in the natural hazard, the reason that they were out there in harm's way is very different. And so as we're trying to prevent modern accidents, we're really looking much more at this sort of recreational environment than an industrial environment.
How often do you produce forecasts and how can the general public get access to those?
Well, the general public can get them by going to colorado.gov/avalanche. We also have a mobile app. So in the Apple Store or Google Play Store, you can find our app. And we put out forecasts every day from November 1st through Memorial Day. And then we put out just general information throughout the summer. We will put out special warnings, avalanche, kind of the same as the weather paradigm. So we have avalanche watches and warnings and an impact-based product called a special avalanche advisory that we'll put out when we see especially dangerous periods. And we do put those out all year round. So it's not common that we'll put one out in the summertime, but if there is a big snowstorm and we see something that we want to warn the public about, we'll continue to issue those. In Colorado, we've had fatal accidents, I believe, every month of the year except for September. So even though most of the accidents happen in the core of the winter, kind of January through March, it is possible to have avalanches in the state throughout the year. And possible for people to get caught up and have a bad outcome.
So another aspect with avalanches is not only the skiers and downslope, maybe buildings and things, but it's also the highways. And I know you guys coordinate with Colorado Department of Transportation. How does that work as far as giving them warnings and having them get out to maybe clear roads or to mitigate avalanches, which might be setting off explosives to set them off by humans and then clear them? How does that all work, Ethan?
Yeah, so since 92, the center and CDOT have partnered on a highway avalanche safety program, and that involves kind of three parts, I guess. You talked about them, but essentially, like, first there's the mapping of potential avalanche paths that affect the highways, because if you look at the mountains, you know, we'll have, say, a peak that has, you know, big avalanche paths on every side, but there's only a highway on one side. And so for that highway program, we really only care about avalanche paths that have the potential to impact the roadways. So neighboring paths, although they're important for the backcountry operation, they really are inconsequential for the highway operation. So then once we sort of establish what are the areas that we're concerned about, the center goes about collecting data and forecasting the avalanche potential in those paths. And then we make recommendations to CDOT about the nature of the hazard and the timing and the location of it. And then CDOT is responsible for actually doing the mitigation work. And so they decide when to actually close the road. We typically we do a few different ways that we'll manage the hazard, from kind of passive sort of engineering, construction and infrastructure sort of approaches, to preventative closures where we might just close the road for a few hours or hopefully not much longer than that to let the peak of the hazard pass, to active mitigation where we close the road, set off avalanches with explosives, and then CDOT maintenance workers go in and clean up the road and prepare it for public use and open it up again. There's a variety of different ways that we do active mitigation, from projectile-based systems that are using, you know, solid explosives. So that's military artillery. These are like Korea-era cannons, 105-millimeter howitzers. There's a gas projectile system that we use called an avalauncher. That was developed in the 50s and 60s, specifically for, you know, trying to get explosives into avalanche paths to set off slides. We do hand-placed charges, so solid explosives, either placing them near the roadway or going out on skis and throwing them, or dropping them out of helicopters. And then more recently, CDOT's been transitioning some of the areas to what we call remote avalanche control systems, which are infrastructure built up in the start zone, so the steep part of the avalanche path, that allow us to set off some sort of explosion. And there, some of them use solid high explosives, again, and some of them use gas mixtures to set off explosives. So there's a whole bunch of different work that gets done there. We work really closely with folks in CDOT, out on the roads essentially every day. And if you, even though each group sort of has their area of responsibility, it's really a pretty big team effort. So if you're out on the road any particular day, you may not know who's working for which organization.
I've seen some videos of them tossing explosives out of helicopters, or I think that was from the Utah's avalanche center, and it must be a fun job.
Yeah,
the little boy in me is coming out.
It is fun. It's pretty serious work. I mean, there's definitely the potential for getting exposed to some dangers besides avalanches. We do a lot of work to make sure everybody is operating in a safe environment and has the support so that they can do this work safely. But flying around in the mountains in helicopters is pretty nice, especially if it's not windy.
Yeah. Well, how many folks are associated with your organization, and are they out in the field a lot? How are you spread out around the state?
Yeah, so we're a small group of 31, and we're spread out around the state. Essentially, we have a couple brick and mortar offices, but mostly we're working remotely, and we're divided up into kind of three regional groups: Northern, Central, and Southern Mountain groups. And there's highway and people, everybody has a primary area of responsibility. So in those regional groups, there are people that are primarily focused on highways and particular stretches of highways, and people that are primarily focused on the backcountry. Colorado is sort of a unique program where we're doing both the transportation and the backcountry forecasting. That's not done that way in other states. And it works well because we have such a mixture. You know, we have all this mountainous terrain with highways moving through it and people, you know, going out into the backcountry. And so we essentially collect data that supports forecasting avalanche conditions, and then we divide that up based on the application. So, you know, we'll kind of do hazard assessments, collect data, do hazard assessments, and then, you know, take out the actual advice that we want to give, say, a backcountry snowmobiler, deliver that to them versus, you know, a highway maintenance worker. And so all the sort of infrastructure that we need to do that data collection, data analysis, hazard prediction gets done sort of together. And then we, you know, divide the advice out based on the application. Of the 31 folks, I think 27, 28, somewhere around there, have some sort of field duty. So the vast majority of the folks that we have are out in the field, you know, a few days a week. To all of their time. We have, you know, again, forecasters that are either focused highway or backcountry. We have a new role this year called a field technician, which is really just doing data collection. And then we have, you know, kind of a small support staff, administrative, you know, project management and IT and communications.
In the time that you've been associated with the Avalanche Center, have you seen some trends in avalanches, severity, intensities, or anything like that?
It's a really good question. And from a data perspective, it's really hard to know. And I can talk about that for a second. And then there's, of course, you know, kind of, you know, the personal perspective that as a, I think is quite real, but as a scientist, you know, it's not something we can sort out from other things that affect people. So the big problem with looking at long-term trends of avalanches is the data sets that we have a really strong observation bias. You know, we document about 5,000 avalanches a year. And we do that by driving around, skiing around, snowmobiling around, and looking at things. And so if we're able to see avalanches, we can document them. But there's a lot of avalanches that happen out there that we can't see, either because they're in, you know, more remote locations or maybe a place that we observe all the time. But there's a prolonged stormy period and we just don't have visibility. So we're really limited to what we as the state's workers and the public, what we see and what the public reports to us. So when we're looking at, you know, the number of avalanches over time or the size of avalanches over time, there's a huge piece that we're missing and we don't really know from year to year how big that piece is. We do have a little better information for the highway paths because they're a little easier to observe, but still there can be avalanches in some of these paths that happen during storm events, and most avalanches happen during storm events, that if it's a prolonged event, it can get covered up and we just never see it. If it doesn't reach the road and you know, the skies don't clear to the point where we can see the start zone during the storm, you know, we may miss it. That said, you know, over the last, say, 7 years or so, you know, we've seen some pretty unusual events, both in terms of avalanches and in terms of weather. We just had a long discussion, actually, 2 weeks ago about a freezing rain event that happened in kind of Eagle and Summit County, and whether it was actually a freezing rain event or whether it was just a rain event on snow, which is sort of what we ended up thinking. But one of the meteorologists that works for the the center, John Snook. He had done some work with mountain meteorology, or had been doing mountain meteorology for quite some time. And, he was like, hey, like, essentially the conventional wisdom is we don't get freezing rain events in the Colorado mountains just because of how the fronts, move through and how they get, the occluded fronts sort of get torn up. And you just don't get that kind of warm air aloft over a cold layer. But we do get like crusts on the snow from more kind of microphysical aspects, riming events and we never really used to get rain events in Colorado, but we do now in the mountains in the wintertime. And so we've seen more stuff like that, and we've seen some pretty big avalanche cycles. The most notable is the one from the March of 2019, which was probably on the order of kind of a 100 to 300 year event, depending on exactly how you try to figure it out and where you look. But it was an unprecedented event in terms of the number of large avalanches over a very large part of Colorado. Typically, we would see kind of extreme events in a drainage or part of a mountain range. But this particular event essentially went from Durango to Winter Park, a really, really, really big event. And so it feels like things are changing, and we have some data to sort of back that up. But the nature of the data sets that we have prevent really strong conclusions. We did that 2019 cycle. We did actually partner with the USGS to try to do some dendrochronology work to look at it. So looking at disturbance signals in tree rings.
Okay.
Because that event destroyed thousands and thousands of trees. And so we were able to go in and collect a bunch of data without destroying trees, because the trees were already destroyed. And we've just gotten some of that, some of the analysis back. We collected about 1,200 samples over the course of about 4 years. And then all those samples, of course, have to be, the actual data has to be analyzed in the lab, which is a huge amount of work. So we're just starting to get some of that back. And essentially, from the data that we were able to collect, there's only one other avalanche cycle in the last 400 years that was close to that size. And that was in 1899, which is an event that we know about from newspaper articles and some historic photos and stuff like that. So, again, trying to come up with return rates for some of these events, there's different techniques and they all have kind of pros and cons. So there's definitely some unknowns still from this sort of technique, but to see that, to see those two big avalanche cycles, and then also to, we were able to partner with some folks in Europe to do a statistical analysis, and essentially the data that we collected shows that the probability of the events that we identified being part of a big avalanche cycle has been decreasing over the last 100 years. So the potential for these big avalanche cycles to happen seems to be decreasing. And yet we have the two biggest events that we, in the data set in the last, 100 years, and the biggest in the last, 5 years. So it's certainly an interesting story, especially coupled with all of the climate change research that people are doing. But connecting all the dots, hasn't been done completely, but hopefully the folks at the USGS will continue on continue with this work and tease more out of that data set.
Yeah, that's fascinating, especially looking at the tree rings and everything. That's something I did not know about for avalanches.
Yeah, it's people have been doing it for a long time, but the way that folks have been doing it has changed, and it's far out of my expertise. We would always, or not that often, but if we had a question, we would sort of sample one tree, or maybe core a tree or something, and just sort of look at how old the tree was and if we could see older events. But this these folks at the USGS in West Glacier up in Montana, Eric Peitsch, and some of the folks in Europe have really started to push what we can get out of these different samples by using more traditional kind of, you know, climatology, dendrochronology techniques, and then building kind of new statistical models. So hopefully there'll be some additional pretty interesting results that come out of their work over the next 10 years or so.
Wow.
It's very labor intensive.
I bet.
It's, you have to be pretty judicious about how you go about this stuff, or you're going to spend a lot of time and not be able to analyze everything that you collect.
Well, we're getting close on our time, and I don't want to take too much of yours, Ethan, but what would you say to the side of avalanches as far as education, teaching people how to dig snow pits and go out, or at least eyeball things a little bit better? You guys are, I'm sure, connected with the education side of avalanche safety. What do you have to say about that subject?
It's changed a lot, and I think it's actually in the U.S. It's getting to a much better place. A few years ago, the American Avalanche Association sort of essentially created two different tracks, kind of a recreational track and a professional track. And I think that was a really important move on their part. You know, when I started doing this, there really wasn't a whole lot of difference between what we taught people and how we taught people to kind of deal with avalanches based on what they were trying to do. And of course, the, you know, what somebody needs to know and how they might approach a particular problem if they're trying to recreate is really different than if they're trying to, you know, run an avalanche safety operation that makes decisions for other people. And so a lot of the kind of snow pit work, that kind of detailed observation stuff that you're talking about, Tom, that's really moved much more into the professional side, where we can really hopefully train people how to collect good data. Because, you know, as I'm sure both of you know, dealing with field science, like, you can spend a lot of time in the field and not collect information that's that helpful. And especially if you're sending, like I am, 25 people wandering around the state, we want to make sure that all the data that they collect is useful not only for them, but for their colleagues, and then for our kind of, you know, longer term data sets that we're using for numerical modeling and, you know, research projects, and to try to answer some of the questions, the long term questions that Greg was getting at. Whereas the recreational side, like, most of those folks, or a lot of those folks, like, you know, they're professionals in other fields. Like, they're doctors, lawyers, construction workers, and they're experts in their professional field. And what they want to know when they're going into the backcountry on the weekend is, I want to go have fun and stay safe, and I don't need to know the ins and outs of snow microstructure and how ice crystals grow necessarily. But they do need to know a bit about natural hazards, where they happen, how to take the forecast and interpret it so they can use it to achieve their goals, which are typically more, you know, I want to ski this slope, I want to, you know, snowmobile this route, I want to climb this peak. They're very, you know, goal-oriented, as all of us are, I think, for recreation. It's about doing a particular thing, not learning everything there is to know about avalanches, which is sort of the path that I ended up on. And so I think, like, separating that stuff out has been super important. We're fortunate in Colorado that the Colorado Mountain College has created with our help, has created a two-year program, a certificate program in snow and avalanche work for professionals. And so most of the training courses that are out there are on the order of, you know, kind of 5 to 8 days or something. And so CMC has a 2-year program where you can watch the accumulation and ablation of the snowpack and how the avalanche cycles ebb and flow through that over 2 seasons with instructors. And that, you know, we were talking a little earlier about, you know, the changes of remote teaching and remote working. That program is mostly hybrid, so people can do it from anywhere in Colorado or even out of the state, and then has kind of 3 1-week periods each winter where people come to Leadville and are actually, you know, interact with instructors and are out in the field and take exams and things like that. And so most of what Avalanche workers could get in terms of education before this was either these sort of short classes or, you know, going to Metro State and getting a meteorology degree, which is a really good thing to do if you want to work in avalanches. But there wasn't a lot of like long, prolonged professional training in avalanches. It was either, you know, science in sort of a related field or, you know, very much sort of master apprentice in these sort of short bursts. And so, you know, the array of opportunities out there, I think, is much better now than it used to be. And the way the subjects that we're teaching people and how we're delivering it to people has improved quite a bit as well. I would encourage folks, if they're interested in professional avalanche work, to definitely look into the American Avalanche Association courses and the program at CMC. And if you're interested in recreation, there's a lot of just good material out there in terms of books and videos and online stuff. But if you want to be in avalanche terrain, taking a course where you're in the field with an instructor for a few days, there's really no substitute for that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Just for, I mean, there's more people up in the mountains, so your chances of triggering something seem to be much higher in that respect.
Yeah, well, certainly, you know, to have an avalanche accident, you need the potential for an avalanche, and you need people. And when we have more people, even if we consider that the avalanche conditions are not changing dramatically year after year, you know, we would see more accidents. We in general are not seeing more or a steep uptick in avalanche interactions. If you look throughout the U.S., it's a little different in Colorado, but if you look around the U.S., the number of fatal accidents is essentially flat over time. And so with the big increases in use and not big increases in fatal accidents, there is a success story kind of baked in there someplace. And I think that it's really a combination of the forecast centers, you know, putting out good information, these educational groups providing good training for people, and the recreational communities really incorporating that safety message, that safety value into their recreational communities. I mean, you look online and you see, you know, forums where people are meeting other folks to go out into the backcountry, and a lot of what they're talking about is, you know, what kind of equipment they have and what kind of training they have. And, you know, so I think as a community, we've been able to make a lot of progress on avalanche safety, but it's not from a single prong. It's a combination of all of this together.
Well, I want to thank you personally for the service that you provide, and I really appreciate you being here today. You have a unique combination of personal and professional experience and a passion for what you do, and I'm just so glad you're in the position you are.
Thanks, Greg. That's very nice of you to say, and I'm glad that the work that we do at the center is useful to you and to everybody else out there in Colorado. Like, we take what we do very seriously, and you know, like you said, this is a passion of ours, but we also, you know, are really trying to help people enjoy the public lands of Colorado in the wintertime and do it safely. And really hope that everybody does get out there to enjoy our public resources, because they are amazing.
That's for sure. And for those folks that are maybe moving into Colorado, there's a lot of them that are looking at taking up skiing or getting out to the backcountry. I would also encourage them to look at a lot of the information online, watch some of the videos, Google the Colorado Avalanche Information Center for this state's forecast, and you have the forecast posted every day and updated, so it's a great resource, but there's a lot of material out there, and it's good to get at least familiar with it and understand the risks associated with avalanches if you're recreating out there in the backcountry. So I also appreciate the service that you and your organization do.
Thanks, Tom. And yeah, you know, definitely use our service, colorado.gov/avalanche. And, you know, there's both the forecasts and a lot of introductory training material. And if you have a question, just click the contact form and write us.
Okay. All right. So we're going to conclude our discussion with Dr. Ethan Green from the Colorado Avalanche Information Center here in Colorado, obviously. And I appreciate him joining us. This has been really a fascinating subject. It's something that I'm always interested in when it comes to snow. If any of you would like to ask questions or want to contact us, again, our contact point is h2opodcast@aol.com. If you want to email us with questions or suggestions. And I appreciate everybody joining in today. I'd like to thank Ethan for joining us. And Greg, anything to add?
I just wanted to thank Dr. Ethan Green for the service that they provide. And I really appreciate his pragmatic approach to encouraging people to use the resources of Colorado and enjoy the backcountry in a safe way.
Okay. And one quick programming note before we go. The two Toms and Greg, the three amigos, are going to be taking a little break for the holidays. So we'd like to wish everyone a Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Holidays, and we will see you when we return in 2024. Well, with that, thanks for joining us, and we will see everyone next time. Thank you. See you later, guys.
Goodbye.